Good. So welcome, everybody. Welcome, particularly if you've just joined us from the introductory course. I hope that the course, that you had enough time to finish the course, as it were. It's very nice to see you in here. It's very nice for all of us to be together in one room at the class. My name's Niyanav Archer, and I'm going to be talking in the second half about a particular sutra that we recite in the puja, the sevenfold puja, which some of you will be familiar with at least, and it's called the Heart Sutra. If you've not been here before, or if you've not been here for a few weeks, myself and Suryagupta have been talking about the sevenfold puja over a number of weeks, actually from the start of the year, or pretty much from the start of the year. I'm not going to be able to recap, but I would recommend catching up if you're interested on Free Buddhist Audio. You can, or just if you just go to our website, you'll be able to find links either on our YouTube channel or onto Free Buddhist Audio to this set of talks in the series. The Sevenfold Puja is a liturgy, is a ritual that we in this tradition, in the Triratna Buddhist community, we regularly perform. So the Heart Sutra occurs towards the end of the Sevenfold Puja. And if you were here in the first half, we recited it before the meditation. And the Heart Sutra is said to be the quintessence of wisdom. It's said to be the perfection of wisdom. Well, it comes from a tradition called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, and the Heart Sutra is a particularly condensed form of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings, a particularly sort of pithy form of that. And in the puja, if you've been following the series, it's immediately preceded by a section called Entreaty and Supplication, where we ask for a teaching. We ask the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the forces in the universe, the enlightened mind, if you like, we ask for a teaching. The whole of the puja, you could say, is an archetypal journey towards enlightenment. And we've got to the point where we're ready to ask for a teaching. Until then, we've been, as it were, preparing ourselves to receive a teaching. And the final stage of that preparation is to ask for a teaching. It's the stage of receptivity. And last week, Suryagupta talked about that stage. And she also recapitulated on the previous stages of the puja. And in her sort of summary, she was talking about how you can see the stages of the puja as stages that we, as moods, as spiritual stages or moods that we could sort of make sense of in our day-to-day lives. How, in a way, the puja is in poetic, in symbolic form, it's outlining what an ideal Buddhist life would look like, how an ideal Buddhist life would be lived, the sorts of moods and approaches and states of mind that we would be trying to cultivate every day. So she outlined that in her talk last week. But the Heart Sutra is a bit exceptional. What happens in the puja, in the drama of this worship, is that we asked for a teaching from the Buddhas, and then we get this teaching, and the teaching that we get is the Heart Sutra. And it's like the Buddhas take us at our word. It's a bit like the Buddha saying, "You wanted a teaching? Here it is. See what you can do with this." And it's completely uncompromising. In fact, it's pretty much incomprehensible. And if you do understand it, it's shattering. It's a teaching that's meant to turn, well, not just turn our world upside down, but to shatter it, to leave us with nothing to hold on to leave us sort of hanging in empty space from nothing, onto nothing, with nothing beneath us. It's meant to completely upset us. Yeah, that's what we get. So you ask for teaching and you get this uncompromising, shattering, world-shattering teaching. At the end of that teaching, if you've been sufficiently blown apart, then you gain enlightenment. Yeah? So that's the drama of the puja. If you prepare yourself, you purify your mind, you reach this state of tremendous receptivity, positivity and receptivity. You ask for this teaching, you receive this teaching, and it leaves you completely shattered. At least shattered in a particular way. It leaves you realizing that you know nothing, that we know nothing. That all of our assumptions about life, about ourselves, about the world, about each other, are wrong. And what's more, they're completely wrong. They couldn't be more wrong. That's what the sutra is sort of telling us. Even our notions about the Dharma, about Buddhism, are shattered. Even if you do have any notions about Buddhism, the sutra says they're wrong. You haven't got it at all. And of course, the effect that the sutra's trying to have is a very positive one. It's trying to propel us into a state where you recognize not just that you've got it very wrong, but you glimpse for yourself how things really are, in a direct, unmediated, instinctive way, in a non-conceptual way, but in a direct way, you see the world as it really is, and you have this aha moment. The lights go on, and the sutra ends with a mantra that you recite three times, and that is a mantra where you reach enlightenment, you have a realization. The puja, interestingly, doesn't finish there. In the last verse of the puja, the transference of merit and self-surrender, you dedicate your life and everything that you've gained for the benefit of all beings, for the benefit of life itself. You completely surrender any sense that you want anything from life at all. All that is left is this urge to serve others and to alleviate suffering where you can in the world. You dedicate that. In fact, you don't even just dedicate this life. The context is really important. The context is that you dedicate all your lives for as long as there is suffering in the world, which is, according to the Buddhist tradition, it's going to be, well, samsara is endless. So you dedicate all your lives for eternity to alleviating suffering, effectively. And that's the effect of the Heart Sutra. You realize the way things are, and it's as if there's nothing of you left. There's nothing left that you can call me or mine. At least that's one way of putting it. The positive equivalent of what the experience is when you see things as they are is much harder to talk about. And the Heart Sutra doesn't talk about it. The Heart Sutra leaves you with a mantra, The Heart Sutra mainly says what the delusion is. It mainly says how we've got things very wrong. It doesn't say what's really going on. Not really, although I'm going to try and point to it as best I can. So as I said, until last week, Suryagupta and myself, we've been trying to make the themes from the puja relevant to our lives as best we can, make them appropriately meaningful. But with the Heart Sutra, in a certain sense, Bhante Sangharakshita, my teacher, says that it's not relevant. It's really gloriously not relevant to your everyday life. If it were relevant to your everyday life, well, either you've been living an exceptional life, or you haven't really got the Heart Sutra. Yeah, it's gloriously irrelevant to the normal concerns that we have in our day-to-day thing that we call life, in our day-to-day sort of business of living. It's gloriously irrelevant to that. So think about all your preoccupations that you have with your day-to-day life. All the things that you're concerned about, your concerns, but also, I guess, your hopes, your priorities, your desires, your disappointments, your ambitions, your hurts and resentments, your worries, all of that, the Heart Sutra is not going to address them. Yeah, it's not going to address them. It's saying, well, if it does address them, it's saying you've got it very wrong. All of that is irrelevant, gloriously irrelevant to really what it is to be alive. None of what we think is important from the Heart Sutra's perspective. In a way, the Heart Sutra is speaking, it's the Buddha speaking from his enlightened wisdom. And his enlightened wisdom is, well, it's from another dimension. The whole point of enlightenment is that it's not to do with how we normally experience things. The Buddha's perception, his experience, in a certain sense, is completely other. It's completely other. It's a bit like he's from outer space. I was talking to Subhuti, who's my preceptor. He's a man who ordained me. And I was talking to him about Bhante Sangharakshita, who's the founder of this order and movement. And I was just saying, Sangharakshita, who recently died at the age of 93, was an extraordinary man, by sort of any stretch of the imagination. He wasn't perfectly enlightened. He wasn't a Buddha. He never claimed to be. But I believe he was the most spiritually developed man that I ever met. Most spiritually developed person I ever met. He had an extraordinary life. I mean, by ordinary standards, it was extraordinary. You have to read his memoirs to sort of know what I'm talking about. He was also a very particular character, quite a peculiar character, not a conventional man in any sense of the word. But it's not even that I was referring to when I said to Subhuti that Bhante is sort of extraordinary, that he's strange. It was something about being with him that Well, I can remember being with him, and he would talk in a very ordinary way. He wasn't ever trying to put on a show of being somehow spiritual. He sort of obviously didn't believe in that. In some ways, he would downplay everything, and we would talk about whatever, I don't know, whatever he was reading or whatever I was reading, or about the London Buddhist Center or about classes or about whatever was on my mind. He'd sort of chat away, we'd chat away. But practically every time that I met him, I had the sense that he was sort of talking at one level, but his mind, or at least part of his mind, was somehow occupying a different dimension, altogether. You had this uncanny sense of that. And the last time I met him, I didn't think I picked up on that sense until right at the end of our meeting. We were just chatting away, and I wasn't very receptive to some other dimension of his mind. So I was just thinking, what do we say next? I don't know what he started talking about Mary Queen of Scots. I'd seen a play, Mary Queen of Scots, and he knew more about Mary than I knew. I mean, he knew more about everything than I knew. Anyway, so he started talking about her. I realised I wasn't in the faintest interested in talking about Mary Queen of Scots, but that's what we were suddenly talking about. Anyway, we finally sort of stopped talking about that, and I asked for his blessings. And this was me, in a way, becoming receptive to that other dimension. And in the puja, we've just become receptive in entreaty and supplication to that other dimension. And you receive a teaching. And from Bhante, I received a teaching, but it wasn't conceptual, or at least not particularly. He just looked at me and said, well, you've definitely got my blessings. And you've had them in the past, and you'll have them in the future. But it wasn't the words. It was in that moment, I think I remembered again, that he was, always has been, connected, I think, to another dimension, to another way of perceiving reality. And it was momentarily thrilling. It lifted me into another state. And on my long retreat, I was then on a 6-month solitary retreat, and that kept coming back to me again and again. And the Heart Sutra, or at least the teachings of the Heart Sutra, or what I kept coming back to, were what I was reflecting on. And every so often I'd get a glimpse of the true import of it. But it was with the flavour of Bhante's blessings. And the reason I say all of this is partly to say that there's something very, very positive going on. That all of Buddhism is trying to point to an experience, another way of being, that is extremely positive, that is true, that is liberating. And in order to experience a glimpse of that, we're going to have to let go of our normal way of being. And all of Buddhism is saying, can you let go? Can you prepare yourself to let go of everything that you think of as known, of everything that you hold dear, everything I hold dear? Can we let go and experience something unknown? Can we do that? Of course, that that only works if you've got a context for it. And traditionally, you need a teacher. And I've been very fortunate in having Sangharakshita as a teacher and other people that I know who have been teachers to me. Because without that, letting go isn't enough. You could let go of everything that you're holding on to and fall into a pit of despair. You could let go and think there's nothing worth living for. You could let go and become cynical think, well, actually that didn't work. I didn't really have this light bulb moment. Nothing happened. And then you just become cynical. So letting go on its own isn't enough. The context is everything. And remember that the Heart Sutra happens within the context of the puja. It's within that context, within the context of committing ourselves to an ideal that transcends us, to a life of service towards that ideal, to studying the Buddhist path, to dedicating ourselves to alleviating suffering wherever there is suffering. It's within that context that we let go of the known, of holding on to us, and then something opens up. So I want to say all this because otherwise the teaching of the Heart Sutra is at best meaningless, and at worst, as I say, it can lead to a nihilistic sort of despair. It can lead to a sense that there's nothing and nothing worth living for. Whereas actually the opposite is true. What Buddhism's saying is that we really haven't, if we haven't glimpsed enlightenment, we haven't really glimpsed what life is at all. We haven't really glimpsed who we are. We haven't glimpsed the power of the mind. We haven't glimpsed real fulfillment, real bliss, real freedom, real love. None of that have we really, really tasted. And that everything, even our peak experiences in life, are kind of pale shadows of what's possible for us. So the Heart Sutra then starts, in a way, it starts with a context of its own. It starts with the words, at least as we recite it. We're reciting an English translation. There are lots of English translations of the Sanskrit, and it's a poetic translation. It's not necessarily the most accurate translation. But the translation that we recite starts with the Bodhisattva of compassion. They're the words, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And that's significant in itself. That sets a context, a frame for what's going to follow. Because the context is one of compassion, of trying to realize the truth so that we can become forces of compassion, so that our life becomes a force for good in the world. That's the Buddhist ideal. Anything short of that context isn't Buddhism. And if we think of gaining enlightenment, gaining bliss, freedom, fulfillment, just because of ourselves, then we won't really gain enlightenment. And if we what's worse is that we might think that we've seen something, and really we just make more obstacles for our own selves. What can easily happen with Buddhism is that it becomes a sort of spiritual selfishness. it becomes a refined selfishness where I meditate and I become happier and I think, great, I can now get on with getting what I want in life. Does that make sense? That you, if you practice Buddhism for any length of time, you will become happier and probably, yeah, there's no guarantees, is there? And the danger is that we appropriate Buddhism for our own egotistical ends, and it just becomes another form of selfishness, another form of refined selfishness. So the context is compassion, that we're trying to become less selfish so that we can become more of more service to the world. Yeah, that's the Buddhist ideal. So it's the Bodhisattva of compassion who utters these words, who is speaking to us in the Heart Sutra. And he's speaking to us about the essence of Buddhist wisdom. And the sort of key lines, at least the ones that I'm going to dwell on in the Heart Sutra, are towards the beginning, where it says, "Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form." They're the lines that I'm going to dwell on, or at least try and unpack a little bit. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. So by form, actually even that's not very straightforward in Buddhism. One way of thinking about form, and this is wrong by the way, is form is the external world. Yeah, the external world of matter and perceptions. All the substance in you know that we think of as objective and out there, the external world. Buddhism tries to categorize experience into different, it breaks it down into different parts, different models break it down into different numbers of parts. And one model breaks it down into five parts, five heaps, five skandhas, they're called. And the first of them is form, rupa. And you could say it stands for the external world. The reason I say that that's wrong is because Buddhism doesn't necessarily believe in an external world. The Buddha, or the Buddhism, doesn't say that there isn't anything out there, but it doesn't say that there is either. It's sort of pretty agnostic about whether there really is an objective reality independent of us or not. Yeah, whether there's actually anything out there in terms of form, in terms of matter. It's saying that you do experience things, we do experience things, but we don't really know what we're experiencing. All we've got is our experience. Yeah, all we've got is our experience. We can never get behind our experience to what's really there. That's what Buddhism's saying, Western idealist philosophy would also agree with, actually psychology would agree with, common sense would now agree with, that you don't really know what's out there. You've got your sense experience and experience through other instruments perhaps, but that's all we've got. We've got our experience. We don't really know what's out there. So rupa or form, when Buddhism talks about form, one Buddhist scholar called Gunther says that rupa refers to the objective pole of the perceptual situation. What he's getting at is that we have perception, and in perception it seems to be like there's an object of perception and there's an internal experience, which I think of as me and mine. So we think we seem to perceive in terms of an out there and an in here. That's how the world appears to us. That's the perceptual situation. As if there are objects out there, including, by objects, I mean anything that appears to perception. So you guys are part of my so-called objective world, and I am of yours. There's an objective kind of out there and a subjective in here. Apart from, Buddhism says, that's just how it appears to us. We don't really know what's out there. And actually, when we look in here, we don't really know what's in here. And what Buddhism does say is that behind that perceptual situation, there are no real independently existing objects. And then within, there's no real independent existing self. There's no independently existing me having an experience of an independently existing world. All there is this experience that we call perception. And it seems to have an objective sort of pole to it, dimension to it, and an inward subjective dimension to it. But really, there isn't a true separation between the two. So that's weird enough. That's just form. That's just rupa. Yeah. Do you see how the Heart Sutra starts, even with that little explanation of the word rupa, it's starting to undermine our ordinary notions of what's going on. Yeah? Our common sense notions of what's going on. It's starting to undermine that. All of Buddhism is trying to undermine that, but the Heart Sutra presents us these teachings in an uncompromising, kind of neat way. Yeah. So form is no other than emptiness. So does anybody want to have a go at saying what that might mean? Form is no other than emptiness. What do you think is meant by that? What's emptiness?
Is it the absence of anything?
The absence of anything. Well, that's a good kind of stab, because emptiness implies something like that, doesn't it? When you hear the word emptiness, you would normally think of a vacuum, possibly, or something, the absence of anything. Yeah, actually, it's not quite that. Emptiness here is not, it's not a great translation of the word shunyata. The Sanskrit word is shunyata, and in some ways, it's not a great translation. Literally, it's a fine translation. Shunyata does mean emptiness. It's just that the connotation of shunyata, what it's trying to get at, isn't the same as the connotation of emptiness. Yeah, because emptiness easily in English means the absence of anything, as you said. So you could say that form, if you got this wrong, if you got it wrong, you could interpret this sentence as saying form doesn't exist. Yeah? The actual words are form is no other than emptiness. And if you're not careful, you could think form doesn't exist. Yeah? That there's nothing there. And that's not quite, in fact, that would be a fatal kind of error. What Buddhism says is that that is a danger of nihilism. If you fall into that, you in a way you open the door to madness, possibly, but potentially to more likely to despondency, depression, despair, a sense that there's no meaning because nothing really exists. Nothing really. exists at all. So one of the dangers of this teaching of emptiness is that we misinterpret it and we fall into nihilism. Yeah. So we're going to try and avoid that this evening. I don't want to send you home completely despondent. Well, despondent at all. Emptiness has a technical meaning in the Buddhist context. Shunyata has a technical meaning. And what it means is that form is absent of any essential substance. Of any essential substance. That there is no essential substance to it. So, that's easy for us, I think, or relatively easy for us to understand in our sort of modern scientific age, because we happen to know that matter is made of atoms, which are made up of subatomic particles, which are, well, you might not know this, but subatomic particles aren't made up of anything, really. They're kind of, they're constellations of energy. That might be one way of putting it, yeah? And even atoms are mainly empty space, and these subatomic particles, which are constellations of energy, which can disappear or appear out of nothing, that is what forms our world. There's no essence there. You know how from ancient Greek times, Western, well, since Democritus posited the theory of atoms, I think. And since ancient Greek times, people have tried to understand what is essentially there. What is the essential substance? Yeah? What are we all made of? And, well, modern physics will tell us that there doesn't seem to be an essential substance. Yeah? It's empty of any substance. Modern physics would talk in terms of energy. But energy, if you ask a physicist what is it, they'll say, well, they might wave their hands about, but they don't really know. And it's not a substance. It's not a substance. There's no thing there. There's no things. So form doesn't contain any essence to it. Yeah. So when I drink this water, there is no essence to the water. Does that make sense? There's no... Essentially, water isn't a thing. Go on, yeah.
I just wanted to ask, I've been taught that emptiness means like empty of independent existence. Is that the same thing or not?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's another way of talking about independent existence, is another way of talking about that there's no essential substance. Because one of the things that Buddhism says is that if something is essentially existent and has a substance, that substance exists independently. So if water really was made of something essential, then it would be completely independent of the rest of the universe. That essential thing would be completely itself. There would be this element called water, and you wouldn't need anything else to create it. But actually, because water is hydrogen and oxygen, it's not independent anymore. Do you see what I mean? Because it's made of something else in the universe. And that's another way of talking about how it's not got an essential substance. Yeah? So to say that something doesn't have independent existence is another way of saying it's got no essential, substantial nature. Yeah, good. So the world around us, form is no other than emptiness. The world around us has no essential, substantial nature. None of it. Yeah? None of it. And yet, it appears. Yeah? Here it is. I can drink this water, and it's good. Yeah? It appears. It appears, and I need to drink this water. I'm recovering from flu, and I'm in danger of losing my voice. And it has an effect. It has an effect. It definitely appears, and it definitely has an effect. And yet, when you look closely, I mean, look as a sort of philosopher or physicist would look, you can't say that there's anything essentially there. And yet it appears. So that's already defying common sense assumptions of what's going on. Not only does it appear, but it has an effect. Yeah? So it's not that there's nothing. Buddhism's not saying that there's nothing there, that all this is a figment of my imagination or your imagination, that we've dreamt it all up and it's not there. And we might as well, I don't know, either all go home or commit mayhem or do anything, because there's nothing there anyway, so none of it matters. It's not saying that. It's saying, no, the world appears in all its richness, in all its wonder, in all its colours. It definitely appears. What's more, it has an effect on what? On us, on other aspects of the world. Phenomena have an effect. Phenomena arise. They can be experienced. Life can be lived. And that's important. It's important because depending on how we live, we can cause pain or joy. And that's important. Buddhism is not saying life is meaningless. It's saying life can be incredibly positive, or it can be hell, and it matters which. So it's definitely saying something is important, and yet you can't say what's happening. When you say phenomena appear and you look more closely at phenomena, you can't grasp them. You try to grasp them with your conceptual, with our conceptual apparatus, and we find there's nothing there. Or nothing that can be grasped by concepts. Yeah? So that's form is only no other than emptiness. It also then says emptiness is no other than form. Emptiness is no other than form. Because it's the language that we've got, remember, talks in terms of subjects and objects. And it's very easy to start thinking that emptiness is somehow a thing in itself, like a vacuum, like a property of the object. Particularly if it appears with a capital letter, as it does in the Heart Sutra sometimes. But emptiness is not a thing. All emptiness is trying to get at is that there are no essences. It's not a noun. It's not meant to be standing for the essential self or substance. It's not a substance. It's not a thing. Yeah. So it's not. So the second part of this phrase says that emptiness is no other than form. So don't start to think that form is only emptiness. Aha! Emptiness is what everything is made of. As if emptiness were the ultimate substance. And we now know that atoms are made of emptiness. No, emptiness is not a thing either. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is no other than emptiness, and emptiness is no other than form. Yeah? So a rather, perhaps an obscure way of talking about this thing that there are no substances. But then the sutra goes on and says, feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. And now what it's doing, it's turning towards the internal aspect of experience. So it's breaking down internal experience into feeling, thought and choice and consciousness. Actually, thought is a pretty rubbish translation for sanya. The word is sanya, which is better translated as perception. And what the teaching is, what the teaching of the five skandhas is saying is that you, just as you can say that the objective bit is called form, the subjective bit of experience, you can break down into these other four components. You can say, yeah, we've definitely got feelings. Feelings in the term, feelings here doesn't mean emotion, it means sensations. So sense experiences, we've definitely got sense experiences. Yep. We've definitely got perceptions, again, through our senses and through our mind. We've definitely got volitions, choice in this word. We've definitely got impulses, desires, will. We've definitely got the ability to choose. And we've definitely got something, some experience of being conscious. Whatever that is. Yeah. Apart from those things, Buddhism's saying we don't exist. I mean, oh yeah, we have form. Our body has form. And then internally, we have feeling and perception and volition and consciousness. But I tend to, my common sense tells me, yeah, quite apart from all of those things, there's an I, there's a me, in this case called Jnanavacha, who has the feelings, who has this body, who owns those feelings, this body, who is behind somehow those feelings and this body, who makes the choices. Does that make sense? That's how we normally think of ourselves, don't we? We think that there's a me having the experience of body and feelings. And that bit, Buddhism says, is illusory. It's a construct. It doesn't exist. There is the body, which is empty, and there are feelings, and there are perceptions, and there is volition, and there is consciousness. There is experience, basically. There's experience. But there's nobody behind the experience sitting there in the control box, having the experience, saying this is my experience. So that's fairly shattering. If you really take that on board, that's pretty shattering. It's not saying that nothing's going on. It's not even saying that, in a certain sense, that we don't exist. It's saying that we don't exist as an essential self or as an independently existing entity. We are a set of processes, a set of conditions, as is the rest of the world, that we think of as out there. And none of it's really independent. All of it is one, in a way, one sort of synthetic whole. You can't really separate out this bit of the universe from that bit of the universe. None of it would make sense without... Do you know what I mean? We now know that there's this black hole at the centre of our galaxy, apparently. So that's a fairly weird thing to be happening. But if that black hole wasn't at the centre of our galaxy, presumably the stars in our galaxy would just... I don't know what they do, but they wouldn't have formed a galaxy. Our sun wouldn't be here. If our sun wasn't here, well, none of this would be here. We wouldn't be here. Somehow, we're connected. One of the conditions for us being here is the black hole at the centre of our galaxy. That's really weird, but it's true. Yeah?
Is that compatible with the idea of reincarnation?
that we don't have an essential self. How is it? Yes, how is it compatible? Well, what Buddhism says is that there is, according to the tradition, there is something of us that continues after the death of the body, just as there is consciousness in when the body's alive. There's volition and consciousness and experience. Consciousness and volition continues after the death of the body, without the body, or at least without the physical body. But just as when we were alive, there was no me behind the body and with behind the volitions and the consciousness, well, after death there isn't either. So something of the process that we are carries on and can take another body, another form. But there never was an essence to it in the first place. You know the... I was thinking of rivers, and rivers are a good analogy, aren't they? Because rivers, I was thinking of the Niagara River. There's that lovely poem by Kay, who is it? Kay, anyway, I can't remember her name. Do you know? Anyway, it's called the Niagara River. And I can't remember it. But anyway, she talks about the river. And if you think about a river, it has some sort of shape and form to it. But when you look more closely, you can't say it's a thing. You can just say it's a flow. Yeah, it's a flow. There's no fixed essence to that river. And you can't say that it's separate from, well, the water that makes it up, but also all the conditions around it, the banks of the river and the current and the energy of the river. You can't say it's separate to that. Does that make sense? So it's a bit like we're a river rather than a thing. But not just we, everything is like that. But if you were on the Niagara River and this poet talks about life as the Niagara River, she talks about us on the Niagara River and says that it's difficult to remember. We know that it's the Niagara River, but it's difficult to remember just what that means. What it, of course, means is that there's going to be this enormous break in continuity between one level of the river and another level with this enormous waterfall. And you could say that that's what death might be like. Yeah, a waterfall where the body completely falls away, but the flow continues. Something of the flow continues. But we were never a thing in the first place, just as the river was never the thing in the first place. It's a concept, isn't it? River is just a concept. A Niagara River, the Niagara River, is just a name that human beings have given to a particular flowing experience. Yeah? The Heart Sutra is saying concepts are not reality. They're useful for getting around, but they're not reality. They're not it. How can they be? They're concepts. Concepts are mind-made things. But we are a concept as well. I mean, when I think of me, that's a concept I've applied to my experience and called it me. That's a construct. That's a concept. Yes?
Is it possible?
Say that again.
Is it possible to speak of or talk of in any way whatsoever about that from which emptiness arises?
Buddhism would say that there isn't something behind this flow. Hinduism would say that all of this world is somehow illusory, it's Maya, and behind the illusion there is a reality, which is a real substance. You could call it the soul, or the cosmic soul, Brahman. And that's real, and everything else is illusory. Buddhism's saying, there's no substance, no essential soul behind anything. It's just that if we saw the flow for what it was, if we realized how things really are, if we stopped putting our constructs on everything and took those, if we stopped taking those constructs as reality, we would experience a letting go. And in that letting go, our consciousness, for want of a better word, would experience a liberation. There would be a freedom, a bliss, a fulfillment in seeing things as they are, in the letting go. Something would happen. But it wouldn't be that we'd encounter God, for example. Yeah. Does that make sense? That's a sort of key kind of difference between Buddhism and, say, Hinduism. Yeah. So it's not that there is something behind the empty nature of everything else. Yeah. Buddhism's very, very clear about that. And yet, there is a liberation possible. And that liberation, it's a thing. But it's seeing how things really are. And it is the end of suffering. It's the end of seeing ourselves as separate from the rest of what's going on. It's only our concepts that compartmentalize and separate. If we could really see what's going on, there would be no fear left. There would be no sense that, no fear of death, for example, because we wouldn't, the death would have happened in the seeing. We would have realized that there wasn't a real me in the first place to die. And there would be a sense of connection with everything. And there would be a bliss in that, and a freedom from all pain. So that would be enlightenment. That's what the enlightened experience is about. It's about seeing things as they are. So this teaching of emptiness is pointing to the enlightened experience. From the enlightened mind's perspective, if you were enlightened, you would look and you would see, oh yes, all these constructs, me and world and so on, space and time, they're not really how things are. Of course they're not. Of course they're not. But that wouldn't be a conscious, I mean, it would be a conscious thing, but the interesting thing about the constructs are that they're not conscious constructs. They're instinctive. They're really instinctive. So this sense of me having an independent existence from you and from the world is bred into us. I mean, it's there at the deepest biological instinctive level. It's as deep as the survival instinct. As soon as there was a survival instinct, the survival instinct only came into operation because an organism felt itself to be separate. Does that make sense? So the survival instinct is based on this delusion. So it's that deep. It's not that you'll hear a lecture on the Heart Sutra and go home enlightened. Well, you might. But only if the truth of the teachings of the Heart Sutra drop down to that completely non-conceptual instinctive level. That's what insight is. That's what the flash of lightning that insight is about. But that won't happen unless we really reflect. it won't happen automatically. We have to reflect on these teachings, and we have to normally reflect in meditation on the basis of a very clear, positive mind. And we probably have to reflect for many years and really intensely. Half an hour of meditation once a week, once a day, probably isn't going to do it. Now, it might. I have met somebody, well, actually more than one person, who has had what I think of as spontaneous insight experiences. And, you know, they've never meditated. One woman I met had something on the bus, on the top of a double-decker bus. And she only really made some sense of it when she came to Buddhism and actually when she heard the Heart Sutra. And she said to me afterwards that this was describing her experience. This was her experience. Anyway, it might happen. The number 8 bus tonight. So I'm going to wrap up now. What I am going to say is that, just to go away with this sense that not only are we not seeing things as they are, but in doing so, we're living in unnecessary suffering. And we're causing other people unnecessary suffering. That's why this is important. We don't have to be living like we're living. That the liberation that our minds are capable of is our birthright. It's intrinsic to human consciousness that we're capable of enlightenment. And if we were to see things as they really are, well, one image that I really like that the later Buddhist, Chinese Buddhist tradition has come up with is it saying if you could really see how things are, it would be as, rather than the universe as separate entities, the universe is described as a net of jewels, as an infinite net with an infinite number of jewels. And each jewel is what we think of as a thing. But it's not really a thing, because each jewel is empty of any intrinsic self-nature. But what's more, each jewel in this net reflects, when you look at it, every other jewel in the net. Every other jewel in the net. The whole of the net, the whole of the universe, is in everything. In every grain of sand, there is the world. Everything is in everything. That would be a truer way. That would be how an enlightened being might talk about the nature of reality. It would be a truer way of seeing things. If we could really see that, we would realize that to think in terms of me and my life as separate from the rest is completely deluded. It's very, very silly. And to think in terms of me living for my happiness is the most foolish way of living that we could have invented. The only real sense that there is of making use of this life is to love. Is to love, because there isn't really a real separation. And love isn't just a sentimental thing. It's an active energy of compassion. It's an active force that tries to alleviate suffering wherever it encounters it. So that's what the Heart Sutra is really trying to talk to us about. Thank you.